Blog Talk Radio.
I found you. Thanks for joining me today for the revival of Masonic Home Companion. So much for the experiment with Radio Freemasonry. It was worth a shot. You know, you've got to try and work with your sponsors, as I always say. Except in this case, there are no, the sponsor is you. And life is good. Here we're on the 273rd day of the year. We've just passed the anniversary of the very first telephone call from transatlantic telephone call from Canada to Britain. It mattered in the day. Life has changed ever since. We're well into the autumn now, as you know. Beginning to feel yourself tilting a little bit when you walk around. No doubt. It's the tilt of the. It's just the tilt of the earth. We're on the edge of good things in masonry. I like the fact that we can hunker down with dedicated Freemasons. Odd the way that things have evolved. If we can't anymore distinguish at the door who should and should not become a Mason, that's part of our culture here in North America, I think. But within that, we don't have the criteria or the conviction to do that at the door. And unfortunately, so many of the fellows coming in aren't really, I think. Making themselves aware of the expectations, how Freemasons see one another, not poncy little dress-ups, but as men who are able to pick up the work that was provided in our Book of Constitution that tells us how we see, how we have, and how we continue to see ourselves. The charges do that for us. And today we'll get into a little bit of that, I hope. It's an interesting time. I'm not saying that it's something that we've been overlooking, but I am saying that we're experiencing problems and in the craft, largely because we have, I think, not realized where the answers are. One of the answers lay right in front of us for all these years. And I don't mean that I'm more clever than the average bear. It's just I notice things just like you do. And the things I notice are out of the periphery of my eye. We'll come back to that. Here we the storyline today, the idea is about being in two places at one time. And I want you all to be thinking about local tradition and how you've been proud to uphold the local tradition, and so do I. Difficulty is I uphold an older local tradition. If that's what you're getting at, that you've always done it this way and that's the way it is, well, I'm here to remind you that I adhere to a local tradition that started in the 18th century. And it was done that way for a long time, and you moderns came along and you're talking about keeping things the way they were, but you really haven't. You really haven't. What you've done is you've brought in changes and variations to local tradition. And I'm not real happy about that. My local tradition is the first local tradition, the way it was done in the day. Not yours, not something that's only 20 or 30 or 40 years old, or, you know, limited to just your experience in your lodge. I'm sorry, but we agree to disagree. I'm a conservative. Here I am declaring myself an ancient. Huh? Well, that's the way it is. I want things clearer. And I think the fingerprints of the ancients in our constitution are quite clear. The charges were predominant. And I'm not talking just about the deacons who were put into on the floor of the lodge, but I'm talking about the instruction, the manual. You know, how many of us take I've got a whole drawer full here of instructions to things to assemble that, you know, I never really opened it and never really looked at. And I know I'm the only one in Canada that does it. The rest of you, as soon as you open up a box, the first thing you do is you head to the manual and read every word before you tear into it and get the wrenches out. That's the last thing I do. And I only go to the manual when I'm left with spare parts or something is dripping where it's not supposed to be dripping. These are, so mea culpa, I'm no different. The instructions are, how do we talk to each other when we're together? I want to think that when three of us are together, three Masons are together, and the fourth fellow is just an average man from the public, that when we walk away and he walks away from us, that he wasn't subjected to the coyness of Masons talking about the craft and making him feel like he's the outsider. That's really bad manners. Bad manners. The charges are pretty clear on that. They talk about that with us. So it's not like, oh, who the hell is he to bring that up? It's more, we've all done it. We all can slip. So these are like the rules. What do you do when you come up to an intersection and you want to make a left turn? Do you just wheel away the left turn? No. You put your signal on. How do you know that? We've all agreed on it. That's all. That's all. We've... So we have, we're taught behaviors, you know, behaviors around people that are not Masons. behavior in the presence of strangers, you shall be cautious in your words and carriage. That is, be mannerly and thoughtful of the fellow, that the most penetrating stranger shall not be able to discover or find out what is not proper to be intimated. Does that mean it's not to be intimated that we are Freemasons? Well, judgment call. But to make the fellow feel like he's an outcast, why would a fellow have to be penetrating? That means even with somebody that's curious, we need to be cautious and manage it prudently for the honor of the worshipful fraternity. So we use the catch-all. What this tells us is to be mannerly and thoughtful of the other person. If a fellow is curious, rather than doing it with a couple of our other brethren on a street corner, wouldn't it occur to all of us, of course, to sit down over a cup of coffee in the Penny University and talk and get to the same way someone approached you way back in the day and spoke sincerely? And I don't mean the uninformed commentator. Ignore that person. Ignore that. Remember, when we have that, we see something that's inopportune and one of our brethren presents himself as less than we thought he was, we're taught to remain silent. He will make himself known that way to everybody on in his own way and his own time. We can't do much about that, sadly. But we can correct when somebody is talking to a new candidate and starts talking to them about religion and Freemasonry. It makes, you know, declarations that Freemasonry is of one religion. And sadly, I've heard that repeated. You can quietly correct that later. And it needs to be corrected. When somebody is wrong, it's bad manners to be quarrelsome in front of company. But good manners and fraternal to question the merit of what was said if we're not on the same page, as they say. You know? As it says, you may enjoy yourself with innocent mirth, treating one another accordingly, according to ability, but avoiding all excess. Here's an interesting part. Tell me what it means, treating one another according to ability, but avoiding all excess, or forcing another brother to eat or drink beyond his inclination. Would you like another one? Ah, come on, you're not a real man unless you have another one. We don't hear that around. If you want one, fine. If you don't, but it's mannerly in many cultures to always offer. It's not being pushy. It's just being mannerly. And to be candid with you, I always appreciate it. That may, and avoid saying things that may forbid an easy and free conversation, for that would blast our harmony and defeat our laudable purposes. Therefore, no private piques or quarrels must be brought within the door of the lodge, far less any quarrels about religion or nations or state policy, we being only as Masons of the universal religion above mentioned, the religion that all men can accept. We are also of all nations and tongues, kindreds and languages, and are resolved against all politics, as what never yet conduced to the welfare of the lodge, nor ever will. The boys in the 18th century could figure it out. The Cook manuscript brought it forward, and we know that Cook copied manuscripts that from the 15th century that we know were replications of something older. We know because of the style of the writing. Well, if fellows from the 15th century and beyond could figure it out. What's wrong with us? It's not like we're bad little boys and we're being chastised. It's like, where did we slip? Well, I tend to think we slipped a lot, or not, and often, way back. And when we slipped, it was not on purpose, I don't think. You've heard the fellow say, well, we don't have to read those things. There's a summary that's read every year at installation. Think about it. Again, local tradition. My local tradition is the first local tradition. I just wasn't around then, but I respect it for what it is. It's the first local tradition. And it taught that when we were making a mason, before we had the articulate, refined degrees that we have today, and by the way, they still need work in my estimation, but great pieces of work, incomplete. The new member was expected to read the charges. That was it. Now, would you let him read a summary? He knows nothing about the craft. The charges were giving him that idea. The idea is about us. This is the way we see each other. Do you fit in? Do you think you can do that too? Do you see some value in this type of attitude to the world around? Can you be discreet? Can you be thoughtful? And you're going to offer him instead. You're going to rob him of that information and just offer it in a summary. Is that right? Really? And we shouldn't wonder that this is new. This has been going on. That kind of a notion has been going on since we slipped. The charges move to the back of the book, section 6 of the Book of Constitution. Not that it was done deliberately. It's the question is, where do you put it? Well, if generations of good masons had slipped, and the significance and importance of the ancient charges became blurred, you would want it in there because it was an integral part of the very first constitution. You and I know that. So we would put it at the back. We would put one of the most precious elements of Freemasonry, a secret, in view for all to find, even with an instruction. Wow, this one's hard to swallow. The instruction is there to be read at the making of a mason or at the behest of the worshipful master once a year. Worshipful master sits for 1 year, so the idea is once a year. And if he's in for a second year, it's worshipful master for 1 year. So we wonder why we've developed some interesting attitudes. Is that a local tradition too? Is that one of the local traditions that I'm expected to accept because it's you moderns are saying so? Well, I don't. I don't accept that at all. And as a matter of fact, without these guidelines and outlines of conduct, it helps to explain that we seem to want to change the way we see each other. We seem to want to accept that a goodly proportion of our meetings will be tedious with fellows wanting to hear themselves talk, that they will rely more on the discourteous attitude or manner with one another that they're making up as they go along, rather than relying on time-proven elements. You are to act as becomes a moral and wise man, particularly not to let your family, friends, and neighbors know the concerns of the lodge, but wisely to consult your own honor. You ever think about that? Wisely to consult your own honor and that of your ancient brotherhood. It doesn't say modern brotherhood, local traditions, ancient brotherhood, for reasons not to be mentioned here. Personal reasons. Your conscience. You must also consult your health by not continuing together too late or too long from home after lodge hours are passed, and by avoiding of gluttony or drunkenness, that your families be not neglected or injured, nor you disabled from working, or you disabled from working. Don't push. Keep it in balance. The caution is all of these things. The truth be known, we're grown men. We can ignore what we choose to ignore. We have mighty powerful egos, don't we? We're always right, except when we're repeatedly wrong and opening our mouths to make fools of ourselves. But here it's saying, ignore this at your own peril. Ignore any of the charges. There's a price for ignoring them. It doesn't say that at the bottom here. You old rascals, you let us discover that for ourselves. Probably because you discovered it for yourself. And you knew, even if you put that in, you be aware, if you ignore this, there's a consequence. Ah, silly old man, I'll just ignore that. You knew if you put that in, we'd just ignore it. But the power is when you learn the lessons. Bang. And it's one of those, why didn't I pay attention to this earlier? I'm that old school. I don't like peaks and quarrels. Well, don't whine to me. Do something about it. Oh my, it's already been done. If you're a poor student, gee, I can't do my maths. I can't read a page. Well, have you tried? Have you studied? Have you found a good teacher? Well, if you haven't, what you're doing is whining. What are you going to do about it? You've got a problem. Find the solution. If you're not sure of the solution, ask. What? We always should weigh things out by examining our options, shouldn't we? But there's the dilemma. I think it's a legitimate dilemma in Freemasonry. You seem caught. And that's what I thought just revealed, that we were trying to be in two places at the same time. Being literal, being metaphoric, being ancient, being modern, being old, being new. If we understood what motivates us each day, we would be dressed either in uniforms or colorful displays of individuality. What motivates us each day? To be the same as everybody? To fit in? Get in a uniform. What's the uniform of the day? Blue shirt and blue jeans? Well, or green shirt if I'm working on the farm? Work clothes. Or, if I'm in an office, shirt and tie, maybe a suit. It's a uniform. Or, if I'm more confident in myself, I'll display some individuality in the way I dress. Maybe with color, maybe with style and fabrics, textures. Would the search for knowledge be based on a desire to resolve conflicted thoughts? I can't figure out this notion about going to war for to defend my faith when my faith teaches me not to kill? I can just flip that one off, can't I? I can. I can be taught how to just flip that switch off. Always comes as a price to the individual. But we tolerate that, don't we? We're really good at that. So are we saying calm reflection is not only possible, but is a product of the enlightened mind? How do we figure out these things? Well, we stop and think about it. We look at the options. We consider the thoughts of other men. And it helps to influence, but doesn't make our mind, doesn't make our decision. We can view things with some degree of impartiality. We view new ideas that way, impartially. Now, to think that everything that doesn't agree with our silliness means it's a pointer that we're wrong is really rather bleak. There's nothing wrong with your ideas. You can walk around wrong all you want. I do. We do the best that we can. And some of us are very sharp at that. We want to be that precise. And others, it doesn't matter. Freemasonry takes that out of the conversation. It does matter. If we begin to think equality means everyone will think like me, then I'm setting myself up to be disappointed. As a man ages, his experiences help mature his thinking. Unless he has chosen to stop growing or has reached his capacity and is capable of no more. My own resentment was people laughing and mocking old farmers. I learned a lot from old farmers. My family, shrewd, tough, intelligent, always being mocked, eh? You can let yourself stop. You can simply say, that's as far as I can go, as far as I want to go. I only want things that are familiar to me from a day gone by. I'm going to live in a limited existence. I'm going to ignore the change that's going around so that when there is catastrophe, I won't be equipped. I'll be equipped to function in a world 40 years ago. Nobody has ever said to you, nobody, that you ignore your experience in order to accept and adapt to what's new. Nobody ever said that. If you felt that way, well, fool on you. The new experiences around us are simply evolution, changes. Slow, gradual changes. And they begin to make sense if you begin to learn about them. If you don't, it can be quite difficult. If we could whisper one message to every candidate, it would be this. Beware. You are unique, so you will begin noticing things that challenge you. Be patient. Learn through silence. Hey, old guy, what does all that mean? Well, that's our conversation over a cup of coffee. As we begin our studies, old ideas will become new through us. We don't do that by saying, you're young, you're stupid. We don't do it by saying, by insulting. Unless we're completely useless. We're not teaching when we do that. Nobody ever learns from an insult. Nobody. It wounds. The old ideas are channeled through us when we exhibit some patience and thoughtfulness and watch for the opportunity to bring up a point for a discussion. As we say, as we begin our studies, old ideas will become new. We discover and rediscover. Oh, I was quite fascinated when I heard somebody describe a man who changed heaven and earth in one day. Copernicus, you know, went from the earth being the center of the universe to what? The universe, he said the sun. Great, huge star. Well, and all the planets were revolving around it. Now we know the universe, that's a galaxy and it fits into a bigger universe. But he changed that in one day. And then we find, really, he was working with ideas that the Chinese had been considering and developing thousands of years earlier. So it made me think, what if there are no new ideas, original ideas? What if we discover influences and combinations of ideas that are already out there? What if we share, we have a common intellect, a common understanding? What if that we have the pool of great minds? We also have a ditch full of foolishness. And I don't mean that trivia is foolishness. I mean doing things that shooting ourselves in the foot. That to me seems foolish. If we understand their meaning, our studies, we just might be influenced by them. So we have the what is going on, and then we were given the opportunity to arrive at a sense of meaning for ourselves. And quite frankly, I'm speaking from the jurisdiction of the Grand Lodge of Canada in the province of Ontario, where this idea of self-discovery, this intellectual self-discovery, is rooted in some very interesting processes for us. Particularly, it's echoed in the fact that in this jurisdiction, we don't have a defined set of landmarks. Wonderful. Why don't they do that? Everybody else has a set. Why don't we? There must be something wrong with our organization. We're inadequate. We've missed the boat. A little deeper thought behind what we're doing here. You are expected to go out and do your research to satisfy your appetite for learning. You tell me what you think the landmarks are, those characteristics and traits of Freemasonry that need to be preserved. The boundaries. Now, we talk to the next fellow and put the same question to him. What are they? The landmarks. What if you have 6 and he has 4? Impartially, do I have any sense that one is right and one is wrong? Only if I suspend that sense of impartiality. Why would I do that? So, you're right within your frame of mind. He's right within his frame of mind. What if, as John Stone researched in 1930, there are 25? Is he more right because he has more? He's written down more? Some men throw a fly in and are going after a brook trout. Some men are throwing a net in and going after mackerel. depends on your goals. 25 may incorporate yours, but what if you come up with an idea that is so precious and so valuable and is so exact that it needs to be brought forward, whether it's written into a constitution or not? That's what I always hope for, that you will do that, that you will be the source of discovery. And that's how, over the centuries, we continue to prosper. We continue to gain. There is no stagnation. Because you and I might think there's stagnation, these other fellows over in that corner of the lodge may think it's a wonderful opportunity. Have at it. Enthusiastic, crazy about everything Freemasonic, studying what the word exception means. If we're going to be accepted, what are we accepting? Overweight and stupid? I don't think so. I'm sorry, I'll burn for that. I don't think so. I don't think we're going to be... The exception has to do with something derogatory. Remember, a lot of people, when we're... Something may not be our fault, but in Freemasonry, we have an obligation to fix it, to come up with solutions. Not to be prancing around saying, oh, I only take care of myself. Well, we're part of a fraternity for a reason. You and I agreed to that. We didn't say, oh, we'll only go along with this fraternity as long as it absolutely agrees with my thinking. I tried that. But then I found there was about 65,000 other people in line ahead of me, all saying the same thing. So here I am at the back of the line. I always seem to get to the back of the line with that one. I never seem to progress. But I'm waiting. I'm waiting for the opportunity when the whole organization starts to fall in line with my thinking. Meanwhile, I'm patient. And I'm going through the... And I'm learning because I'm seeing how Freemasonry looks through your eyes and the other 64,999 brethren in front of you. Don't you just love the way we approach these problems? Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. No question about it. Absolutely none. I'm going to talk about, I have to talk about exception. It's just beyond the pale that we walk around and don't have a point of view when some young whippersnapper asks us what it means. I can't really tell you the first reference. I can, but it's in language that makes me sound foolish because I stumble with the pronunciation of Old English. But it goes back into the day. I think around 1638. I don't know why that comes to mind, except it's just after the Great Fire of London destroyed the old cathedral. Dunn was dead. St. Paul's Cathedral had been built, of course. In the same year, there was a special kind of event that came up at the London's Company of Freemasons. And I'll just try it. I'll stumble over this. Bear with me. Paid which the accountant laid out, which was more than he received of them, which were taken into the exception, whereof 10 shillings is to be paid by Mr. Nicholas Stone, Mr. Edward Kinsman, Mr. John Smith, and Mr. William Millis, Mr. John Coolis. This is our first positive record of the word exception within the context of Freemasonry. We cannot say that Nicholas Stone was one of the first accepted Freemasons, because the relevant records of the company before this time have most regrettably been lost or destroyed or stolen. He may have been one in a long line. Ultimately, the exception may have been a fairly recent innovation at that period. We don't know. We have no substituted secrets to put in their place. We must use our brains instead. Oh. Here was Nicholas Stone, a bona fide Freemason, about as operative as you could ever expect to see, paying 10 shillings to become an accepted Freemason. At a stroke, we see that you cannot properly use the word accepted to differentiate between a member of the or any other Grand Lodge and a person who earns their living from practicing the craft and mystery of Freemasonry. Furthermore, according to the understanding of the master and wardens of the London Company of Freemasons in Stone's time, it would appear to be absolutely illegitimate to tear this dignity, whatever it may have been, from the privileges. The question then comes up. Did the early Grand Lodge know what the word accepted actually meant? Never occurred to me. We must ask this question because it is now highly probable that it did not mean what subsequent generations of so-called speculative Masons have been told it meant. How could we be sure? Well, for the simple reason that all of the men mentioned in the above were craftsmen and members of the London Company of Freemasons. Nicholas Stone had been a master of the company 4 years before this mention and was still not accepted. He had also worked with Edward Kinsman, who had been employed at Sion House as a Freemason in 1604 to 05. Kinsman had succeeded Stone as master in 1635. Frankly, these were among the top in the profession, and yet, with all of their advancements long since apprenticed, they had to wait until their mature years to be taken into the exception. This is extraordinary, don't you think? Do we see here something like the first tangible signs of the genesis of a form of Freemasonry that is not accessible to those who are learning their craft, but only to those who have for a long time, considered the meaning of it? That's to say, is there not something here of the marriage of the art and craft with the philosophy and spiritual underpinning of the trade? We didn't say, my goodness, let's meet... And we'll use a metaphor that has to do with the guilds. Nobody did that. Or did they? It's reasonable to think on these lines, but only because we have so long accepted the notion that an accepted Mason was one who moralized on the allegorical interpretation of architecture in terms of some kind of self-knowledge. It is possible that this interpretation, and it's been misleadingly called speculative masonry, if not actually an error, that is to say, wrong, may simply be too limited a concept. That is to say, divining the true nature of accepted Freemasonry may have been guesswork, once we supposed that those who had been taken into the exception were absolutely compelled never to speak or write about it. Is this what the substitute secrets were substituted for? Is there something of an Oedipus complex lurking behind the modern tale of the third degree? Was the old accepted Freemasonry the Hiram Abiff who refused to give up his secrets so is slain by the new order? They tried to raise him, revived the secret, but could only manage the 5 points of fellowship. Really? Nicholas Stone and his brethren around 1638. Who took them in to the exception? What might it mean to be taken in to such a thing? It seems reasonable to suppose that the accountant at the company had at least some idea of what he was referring to. He appears to have still been unpaid for some of the required dues, and 10 shillings was a lot of money in those days. The exception appears, oh, he could have worked it off in kind and not recorded it.
Yeah.
The exception appears to have been, in a sense, part of a company business. We can't tell for how long. One thing appears to be clear, and will become clearer as we investigate the bits and pieces of records concerning the exception in the 17th century. And that was not for every, this was not for every Freemason. Did every Freemason know about it? We don't know. This exception appears to have been a high privilege. The great question still remains, who was in a position to grant this privilege, if that is what it was? Mr. Stone had already been master of the company, an operative Freemason, and he was not, had not been taken in. Kinsman had been a master, and he had not been taken in. So nothing was automatic. Was there a religious angle?
Mm-hmm.
Was there some kind of company chaplain or spiritual overseer or overseers of the company? As things stand, we can't say. The old guilds and confraternities used to employ priests for both liturgical and scribal duties. They would do the ritual, of course, by virtue of their own training, and they could write. They were literate. There is a Masonic historian who helps, a fellow by the name of Matthew Scanlon. He's drawn attention to an entry in James Anderson's Revised Constitutions of 1738. Remember, they kept going at it. They didn't get it necessarily the way they wanted the first time around. The entry that we're mentioning here refers to something that happened in the year 1720, actually before the first constitution was published. And it may have been connected with an alleged call made by the Grand Master, George Payne, on the 24th of June, 1718. Payne desired any brethren to bring to the Grand Lodge any old writings and records concerning Masons and Masonry in order to show the usages of ancient times. And this year, several old copies of the Gothic constitutions, they were called the Old Charges, for all you moderns out there. Several old copies of the Gothic constitutions were produced and collated. We have to note that Grandmaster George Payne and his colleagues seem to have required educating in these matters. The telling entry, according to Matthew Scanlon, refers to the second term under the Grand Mastership of George Payne. John Theophilus de Saulier held the Grand Mastership during the intervening year. According to Anderson's account, this year, at some private lodges, several very valuable manuscripts, for they had nothing yet in print, concerning the fraternity, their lodges, regulations, charges, secrets, and usages, particularly one writ by Mr. Nicholas Stone, the warden of Inigo Jones Lodge, were too hastily burned by some scrupulous brothers that those papers may not fall into strange hands. In a serious article written for Freemasonry Today magazine in the summer of 2000, Scanlon strongly implied that the strange hands that the scrupulous brothers wished to avoid were none other than those of Grandmaster Payne and his colleagues. This would seem to be a quite logical inference from Payne's earlier call for manuscripts showing ancient usages. Payne was in the process of drawing up fresh regulations, presumably on no authority other than that of himself and his colleagues, such as de Saulier and the Grand Lodge of Venture. Now, Jean, you know from listening to the show that de Saulier was a co-writer, a co-researcher with Anderson. We know that he was the second Grand Master. We know that he traveled up into Scotland, and we presume a piece. We presume that he had been had Masonic intent in mind, because and must have visited lodges, because after he came back, remember, Scotland still didn't have a Grand Lodge. It functioned with very independent Masonic lodges that had been in operation using a ritual that predated any Grand Lodge. De Saulier, we believe, spoke to them about the benefit and the appeal of a Grand Lodge organization, because when he returned to England, affiliations from Scottish lodges increased. Now, perhaps you're one of those Masons who believes in in coincidence, or you're a bit more inclined to follow the laws of probabilities. Probability, the most probable simple explanation is that this great mind, de Saulier, was a scientist, a very accomplished scientist, a member of the Royal Society, and of course he would be able to easily distinguish himself in a crowd. Influence, let's believe that he had something to say that held great merit. The reference to the manuscripts by Nicholas Stone stands out to us. Why was this one drawn out as being a particular loss? And look at how beautifully we put it. The one writ by Mr. Nicholas Stone were too hastily burnt by some scrupulous brothers, that those papers might not fall into strange hands. No coarseness. No claim. What did these fools do? None of that. We're too hastily burned. Why was this one drawn out? The possibility stands that information was being sought on the true nature of the exception. And older members, local tradition, from private lodges, were loath to let anyone tamper with the regulations, charges, secrets, and usages in their possession. They had a pact. They wouldn't let the first Grand Master have access, because they couldn't control who would have access thereafter, could they? It would only be Freemasons. But perhaps in their mind, they were thinking that this would create a looseness. I have no reason to lie to you, brethren, but I do worry about things like that. Anything with a pulse attitude to a candidate and an applicant, it troubles me. Where membership is and recruitment is a matter of revenue units, generating revenue. It saddens me to think that we've moved Freemasonry into that interpretation. I hope I can be convinced otherwise before I die. Indeed, such was their suspicion of the length some person or persons might go to get hold of the material, that they were prepared to burn them as to maintain secrecy. The scrupulous brothers may indeed have destroyed the only clue we might have to determining the nature of the privileged masonry to which Stone and senior members of the company were attached. In the absence of such a manuscript, the only clue suggests that one look again at Vaughan's engraving from Elias Ashmole's Theatrum Chemicum Britannicum. I know that's sitting on your bedstand. That was from 1652. And it's an engraving of the seated master, not sitting masters. Sorry, personal peak. The seated master enjoining his alchemical son and heir to accept his secrets. And since we have mentioned Ashmole, we need to look at his unique record of having been made a Freemason on the 16th of October, 1646. Does his record help us in any way to understand what this exception phenomena was all about? Did Elias Ashmole become an accepted Freemason 8 years after Nicholas Stone? Will you come back? Will you come back to find out? I hope so. That's all I want to talk about today on that topic. That one's more than a little interesting, don't you think? Do you have a better sense of the exception? To me, what I heard was that the exception has to do with the primary fundamental secrets. So we are free and accepted. The accepted means to me that I've made an obligation to keep some things so secret I won't even admit that they exist, unless it's to a brother that I can trust. Wow, that's more than a little profound, wouldn't you say? You know, it's a wonderful time for us in Freemasonry. It's always been like this. Nothing has ever been laid out and clear and obvious. Nothing has been obscure either. But we also have, I think, a new presence. There's some incredible research going on. We're finding out new things about old things every single day. You know, that stream of new information that's coming out of the sciences, well, it's affecting the academics are drawing Freemasonry into that matrix. And what you and I get to do, sit back, read, study, bear witness, consider. It is going to be, will it be revolutionary what we find? It will probably explain some questions. You know, probably. I hope so. It'll answer our questions. We have so many wonderful things to achieve that our brethren would never have imagined. Freemasonry, it's needed today. It serves a valuable, very, very valuable purpose. And it's more than the good man better. What's the point of a good man better? Huh? Well, the point is what you and I bring to the table. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and I look forward to being with you again next week. Take care of each other.